everyone, I'm Colin Ellis, best-selling author, award-winning public speaker, and facilitator of global workplace culture change. And in this, the Culture Makers podcast, I get people managers from around the world to share actionable things that you can do too to create a great place to work. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Culture Makers podcast with me, Colin D. Ellis. And joining me today is Jeffrey Sundberg. Now, Jeffrey is executive partner at Gartner and is a seasoned executive leader with deep experience helping organizations address their most difficult human capital challenges. From a legal role in labor relations to developing government-wide policy and tools in all areas of human capital, to being a trusted partner to C-suite clients by helping them align people's strategies with critical business goals, Jeffrey has consistently delivered results by aligning people's strategy with workforce needs and business priorities. And he joins me today from Bethesda in Maryland, which is near to Washington, Jeffrey. That's right, isn't it?
It is. We are about 20 minutes outside of Washington, D.C. So a great location and a nice community here.
And it's summer. We're recording this. It's June. It's the end of June here in Australia. So it's winter, although it's not really winter. It's not winters that I grew up with in the UK, but I think it's summer there for you. Which is nice.
It is. Summer starting to kick in. We're expecting our usual string of horrendous 90 degree days. But actually, so far, I can't complain. It's been a lovely spring and early summer. We've had remarkably moderate weather. So nothing to complain about. But I'm sure I'll begin whining and complaining soon enough when the hot weather really settles in.
It's funny to say. Maybe I'm going to start. So it's a classic British thing to do, is to start any conversation with the weather. But we used to find, and I used to find as a manager, that people were generally happier. And this sounds like an obvious thing to say, but morale was generally higher when the weather was good. We always tried to do any kind of engagement survey in the summer, never the winter, because people were just generally, oh gosh, it's the winter, right? It's freezing cold.
No, I think that's probably true. I think it's a combination of the sunshine that you get in the summer months and spring months. The dark winter months can have a real impact on people's attitudes and certainly morale, I would think, as well. And I think also in the summer, people are looking forward to the pace tends to slow down a bit. People take vacations. There's a general, lighter mood in the air. I think you're absolutely right.
From what I see from your background, Jeffrey, you've always had an interest in people. I think you did a BA in a Bachelor of Arts in psychology. We'll get onto the law stuff. Is that true? Was there always this real interest in doing people stuff, I suppose?
I think I kind of fell into it in a way. I started my career, as you mentioned, as an attorney. I was a labor and employment attorney, so those issues tended to be people issues and they tended to be workplace issues. Although I handled some other matters as well, but I never found anything that was quite as interesting as the labor and employment issues that I addressed early in my career. And so at some point, several years into my legal practice, I moved into a more general sort of human capital management role. I left a labor union where I was working and leading labor policy and labor relations issues, labor and employment issues, and working on a lot of legal issues for a government position, a senior role in government with a U.S. government agency called the Office of Personnel Management, which is, it's kind of the U.S. government's central personnel management agency. It sets policies, it handles pay and benefit issues for, a very large federal workforce and retirees. And it was a great place to sort of learn more about people, what works well in the workplace, what doesn't. It just really suited my interests and needs at the time. I think I was getting a little burned out from some of the adversarial nature of the law, and was really enjoying a lot more sort of what makes organizations tick, what makes people succeed in organizations, how do you bring about that connectedness and and organizational effectiveness. Those issues really just appealed to me, and those were the issues I started to gravitate towards as I moved further and further away from a legal practice and more into human capital issues and human resources management.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about unions. I grew up in Liverpool in the UK. It's a very working class city, highly unionized workforce. And I was talking about the unions recently in terms of protecting workers' rights. I still don't feel like they do enough around culture. But you mentioned the kind of adversarial nature of the work that you were doing. And I still feel that that's the case with labor unions, even though I guess they're set up to protect the rights of workers, which of course is fundamental to our workplace cultures, right?
It is. And I think that there was a period of time in the 80s and into the early 90s when many of the unions in the United States, and I think in Europe and elsewhere, were experimenting with and moving towards more cooperative labor management relations, strategies where they're partnerships with the companies and employers. And there was a lot of successful examples at the time. In fact, the U.S. government actually tried to borrow some of those when President Clinton was in office and Vice President Gore was looking at ways to what was called reinvent government. One of the strategies he relied on was labor management cooperation. The federal government in the U.S. is actually heavily unionized, and Gore was promoting, and federal agencies were following suit, ways to enhance labor management cooperation. That was actually one of the issues that I was focused on when I was in government, and it worked in many ways. It was built around the notion that unions and their employers have an awful lot in common, not the least of which is the success of the organization.
That's right.
If the organization isn't successful, employees can't succeed either, whether it's in the commercial sector or the public sector. Sadly, I think that effort began to wane, and of course, at least in the private sector in the U.S., unionization rates have hit, they're abysmal. They're just incredibly low. I think they're down to 8 or 9% of the U.S. workforce is now unionized. And so unions have been in this sort of, perennial struggle to make themselves relevant again. And they're still struggling. And now we're seeing efforts, new efforts to organize companies like Amazon, some tech companies. So the unions are trying, I think, again, to find ways to appeal to especially younger workers. But I think they have to do it in very non-traditional ways. I don't think most employees these days are interested in unions that are as aggressive or as confrontational as maybe the models of the past were. And so I think, again, they're trying to find ways to, reinvent what it means to be a union and to represent workers in a very different environment than we were in 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago when unions were much more powerful and much more popular with workers.
It's a fascinating conversation because one of my clients is going through some, let's say, combative negotiations with unions at the minute. And it just doesn't need to be that way. And I completely agree is that there is a need for modernization. I still think, as a former union man myself, there's so much value that they can add, but they really do need to modernize very, very quickly. Otherwise, as exactly as you say, generation. I tried to explain to my children what a union was, and they didn't really understand. There's so much good they can add, but they need to modernize quickly before they become irrelevant. Yeah. Listen, I could talk about unions forever, but let's talk a little bit more about the Office of Personnel Management, which I think I'm right in saying it kind of oversees the entire civil service. Is that right? So the entire public's, is that right? Have I got that right?
It does. The federal, so it provides some policies that govern certain areas of employment. It ensures that what are called the merit principles, essentially that notions of fairness and equity are upheld throughout government when it comes to hiring, promoting, basically any aspect of employment. The Office of Personnel Management tries to set standards so that both potential federal workers and current federal workers feel they're treated fairly and are treated fairly in their jobs. It manages the largest retirement system, I think, in the world, several million pensioners under the federal government pension system. When I was there, I led a couple of different programs. When I started, because of my background in labor and employment law, I actually led a government-wide labor relations program trying to help federal employers and their unions work together more effectively. I moved later on into a role that was more sort of general human capital management. I was essentially, I and my team were working to help federal agencies through their human capital programs, through HR programs, just operate as effectively as they could. So how could they develop a performance management program that really worked for the organization? How could they attract and retain the type of talent that the federal government needs throughout, you know, its many variety of agencies? Organizational culture, we worked with agencies to enhance their organizational culture so that, you know, when they hired people, they'd want to stay and stick around. The government's always in a battle for talent because it often can't pay what the commercial sector can pay, especially for, you know, hard to find talent and people with certain special skills, with, you know, in demand skills. So the government's got to find creative ways to attract people and keep them. And I would work with agencies to help them do that. I also had some oversight and compliance roles as well. I led a team that made sure that agencies had the right standards, the right policies in place to ensure equity in the workplace as well, fairness, diversity, all of those values that the government promotes and cares about. It was my job at one point to make sure that agencies had the right programs and systems in place to make that happen.
And you were doing this in the early 2000s, Jeffrey, from what I can see, which was quite forward thinking back then. I think the culture has always been, I think you have to be a special kind of individual. As a former public servant myself, you have to really want to contribute to the public. You don't get paid the same level of pay that the private sector does. And you're absolutely right when you say that the organization really does need to think about, well, you know, other than compensation, what's a way that we can generate this really great idea? And back in the early 2000s, you really had to be creative. Technology was limited. So it really was about human to human contact. How do we create an environment that has a sense of what we now call belonging? We probably didn't even call it culture back then, right? It was teamwork, but there still needed to be a vision and a set of priorities and an element of fun, right?
Oh, for sure. And in fact, one of the things I found interesting in government service, I spent about a total of 20 years in government service, is that an effective workforce and the way to sort of enable workers to do their very best tended generally to be a nonpartisan issue. And so I worked through different administrations, both Democratic and Republican, and there was generally a fairly equal emphasis on how do we ensure that people who come to work for the government have the tools they need, have the skills they need, and can work effectively as they can on behalf of the American people. That was very much, for the most part, a nonpartisan issue. And so it was always interesting to me to see that evolve over time in government. The techniques may have changed, some of the terminology may have changed, the strategies, but underlying all of it was this, I think, a really important fundamental notion that, you know, what the federal government does is important. It impacts the lives of 300 million Americans, and ensuring that we have the right people with the right skills to do that kind of important work was just as important to Republican administrations as it was to Democratic administrations. There would be different areas of emphasis, different things that various administrations thought were more or less important. But generally, the idea that, you know, the American people deserve a well-functioning government was something everybody cared about. And I liked that about public service. I liked that bipartisan spirit. It's pretty hard to find these days in the U.S. And so I enjoyed working for, and I worked for a variety of different leaders from a variety of, from both political parties. And I enjoyed the fact that all of them sort of understood that and really got it. They understood the importance of people to organizational success. And that that appealed to me quite a bit.
Now, as someone who's managed fairly large teams yourself, then Jeffrey, what are some of the things that you do to actually build a culture, to build that sense of belonging? Obviously, we're now at the point where we've got 3-4 different generations, even in some companies in the workforce. So, for you as a leader, what's important to you? What are some of the things that you do? Some of the strategies that you use to create a great place to work?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with being intentional as a leader about culture, because what I found is that in any organization, large or small, you have a culture, whether you like it or not, or whether you intend it for that culture or not. People behave a certain way, norms develop, ways of working with one another, working with stakeholders and customers, all of that develops. And it can develop in a really productive and positive way, or sometimes it can develop in a fairly toxic way. And I found that where I've seen organizations struggle is where they don't pay attention to culture. And again, by culture, I mean, what are the norms? What are the behaviors? What things do we want to encourage? What things do we want to discourage? How do we want to act with one another? How do we not want to act with one another? And that, which is often as important as what we want to do, it's what do we not want to do? And so what I found helped was to be intentional about it. You know, how do we want to treat one another? How do we want to engage with one another throughout the organization? What kind of behaviors are most important to not only the success of the organization, but the success of people? What kinds of behaviors do we demonstrate as leaders? Do we hold ourselves accountable for as leaders? I think there's almost no way to overstate the importance of leadership in developing a strong culture as part of that intentionality. When I was before I came to Gartner, which is where I work today, I was the chief human resources officer for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a financial regulatory agency here in the U.S. And we found at some point shortly after I joined, I kind of joined as this effort was just getting underway. But what we had found was the culture had soured, and it had developed into a very kind of adversarial culture where people felt they were competing against one another for resources or competing against one another for programs, treating each other very much as adversaries and not partners. And that was having an impact on the ability of the organization to succeed. It was really having an impact on the mental health and well-being of employees. They felt just, you know, beaten down sometimes. And so rather than just sort of throw up our hands or kind of, well, hope, you know, keeping our fingers crossed that would get better, we really took a step back, and the senior leadership of the agency met over the course of several months to very deliberately and intentionally decide, well, first identify what are the things we're doing that we should stop doing. And then once we identify those things, we identified a sort of a suite of behaviors, from meeting norms to how we talk to one another, to how we engage with people, that we tried to hold ourselves accountable for. And it took about a year or so to put it all together and share it with employees, get feedback, sort of refine it and hone it. But I felt it was a fairly successful effort. It did actually change behavior, and it took leadership to really continue to sort of reinforce it and remind people about it, and most importantly, hold each other accountable as leadership, because what we modeled and said, I think, had a huge impact on how employees perceive this effort. But what was interesting about it, and I think what's interesting about organizational culture, is it did begin to dissipate over time as leaders changed, as people came in, as people came and went. And so I think one of the lessons that I learned is, you know, culture is not a one and done effort. If you want to build a good, solid organizational culture and sustain it, you really have to keep at it, because it will backslide. And to prevent that from happening, you really have to keep at it.
It's such a great point. The term that I use is continually intentional. You have to be continually intentional about culture to keep it where you need it to be. I think too often, and it's something I talk about a fair bit, is when people say, oh, we're doing a culture change program. And my first question after that is, and then what? I was like, because you seem to, you know, the concept of a program is that it ends at some time, but culture never ends. It's perpetual. Exactly as you say, it's always there. And it's something, you know, it's like, It's like a bicycle. You always have to pump the tires up if you want the bicycle to keep that forward motion. Now Gartner, who you're working for now, is an organization that has a great culture. It's not the world's leading research and advisory company. It's certainly up there. And what keeps it up there is the culture. Was that a factor in you joining, Jeffrey? Was it something you felt as soon as you walked through the door when you took an interview there?
It didn't take very long. I work in an area of the firm. We provide support to human resources leaders in both the commercial sector and the public sector. And so in my case, I and my peers, we work directly with CHROs and just sort of help them with their people problems whatever and wherever they may be. And so that itself is a very, it's a rewarding role. And so that certainly appealed to me. But the culture of Gartner is a fairly special one. It's very collaborative, again, intentionally so. It's very focused on, it's a professional services organization, a research and advisory, company that provides services to our clients. So it's very client focused, which helps because our discussions, our work, all of our efforts are really centered around how do we ensure the best possible experience for our clients. Now, of course, there's a financial incentive to do that for sure. But I think if it were only that, it wouldn't be the same culture. I think it attracts people who find that type of work rewarding, who get a lot of pleasure and professional reward around helping people and organizations succeed. And so that aspect of the culture, I think that thread runs throughout our culture. I also have the good fortune of being on a team of people who are among the smartest and most collaborative that I've ever worked with. That I think, again, is part of is reinforced by Gartner, and we all sort of thrive in that environment. So yes, I appreciate you mentioning that, and I completely agree. It's been worked in different organizations, and this is among the best that I've worked in, especially from a cultural perspective.
Would you agree that in order to provide the best client experience, you have to create almost the best employee experience, Jeffrey? Do you think that there's a direct correlation between how you as an employee feel and the services you're able to provide clients?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, Gartner has done a lot of research into just that very notion of what creates a great experience for employees. And what we found is a few things. One is that employees really want to bring their whole selves to work. They don't, they see themselves as people first and employees second. They see work as part of their lives and not something separate from it. And I think the whole COVID experience reinforced that as, to a challenging degree, that where does my work day end and where does my home life begin began to be a bit of a muddy picture. And what we also found is that the value that people assign to their organizations is really based more on how they feel, how the organization makes them feel, than it is about any sort of suite of benefits or programs that organizations might offer. And we call that at Gartner the human deal, that aspect of the employee value proposition, the employee experience. We've labeled that or named that the human deal. And it has these sort of elements that I think are really interesting. One is, again, to enhance the employee experience, really deep connections. And that's really the extent to which, as an employee, I feel understood as a person, not just as a number or an employee. Gartner does that, I find, really well. I feel I bring myself to work, and my supervisor and the people I work with see me as a person. We share personal stories about one another. We know about each other's lives. We post pictures of our kids' graduations. And that doesn't happen everywhere. The other thing that Gartner found that employees really value, especially now, is flexibility. And by this, we mean, promoting autonomy, giving employees choices about where they work, when they work, within reasonable boundaries, but giving people that kind of flexibility really enhances the employee experience and enhances organizational cultures. People are still finding their way, I think, in a post-COVID world about how best to balance all of that. The other thing that we found is really important is personal growth. How can you help employees feel valued by helping them grow, not just professionally, but as people? We also found that well-being was incredibly important to employees and helped enhance their experience. So not just offering programs around well-being, but really encouraging people to use it. And one of the interesting things we found that, for example, in organizations where leaders or managers or even peers sort of reduce the stigma around support for mental health challenges, which have become more and more prominent, that really encouraged people to feel good about their organizations. And finally, one other element that we found that was really important to culture and to this employee experience was a shared sense of purpose. People feel very invested in the places where they work when their organizations were willing or are willing to take a stand around societal issues. In the U.S., for example, in the wake of the George Floyd murder in Minneapolis in 2020, a lot of organizations began to have conversations, really open and candid conversations with their employees. We did that when I was at CFPB. We had meetings with employees that were, you know, where people could express anything on their minds, and especially African-American employees were just devastated and talked in the most compelling and personal and vivid terms about the hurt and the pain that they were feeling. And we went through an exercise over the course of that summer where we kept, meeting. We continue to hold meetings. We worked with our diversity and inclusion office to identify some articles, some books, some topics that we could use to sort of spur more conversation. And the point of it was not just to make these personal connections with people and make sure that they felt heard and understood and felt they could bring them their whole selves to work, but to also show that we as an organization at the time cared. And I think employees felt much, much more invested in us as an organization. So all of those elements boost the employee experience around the organizations where they work. They're more likely to stay. They're more likely to characterize their organizations as great places to work. They're more likely to recommend their organizations to others. And so those elements, I think, are reflected certainly in my experience at Gartner, and the Gartner research shows that successful organizations embody those elements as well.
Fantastic. I mean, they're such great insight. I love the human deal. Yeah, that really resonated with me. And I've made a couple of notes that I'm definitely going to go and read a couple of those things myself. I mean, the whole idea of this podcast was to talk about you, not to promote the services of Gartner, but Gartner do provide some real great insights into really culture and kind of what the future looks like. For you, Jeffrey, my last question is, so how do you keep yourself, relevant's probably not the right word, but kind of on top of what's happening in the world of organizational culture, people, you work for Gartner, so there's lots of research there. Do you like to read? Do you like to listen to podcasts? Do you watch video? What's your thing? How do you keep in tune with the way of the world today?
Yeah, I guess I'm still sort of an old school reader. So I tend to read a lot, probably less sort of, business or organizational, less on organizational or business topics. And I still find you can learn as much about people and how people behave from a good novel as you can in just about the other way. So I still do quite a bit of reading and enjoy a lot of nonfiction as well. And again, just sort of learning about people and how people think and feel and how they live their lives. So still do a lot of reading. The team of folks I work with, we are constantly pinging one another with, hey, here's a great article. From any source, here's a great podcast. Here's something you may want to take a look at to learn more about a particular issue. So there's about 17 or 18 of us on this team. And so I often stay current just by, listening to or reading what my colleagues are listening to or reading. So those are some of the ways that I try and, keep up, still read two or three different newspapers a day. That I've moved away from print to online. And so that helps as well, because, most of the major media sources report pretty heavily on organizational issues. And so that's a great way to stay current too.
Yeah, more so than ever, they do report on culture. Jeffrey, it has been fascinating talking to you this morning. I've taken so much from it myself personally. I want to say a huge thank you for giving up your time and for being a guest on the Culture Makers podcast today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Colin. I appreciate the invitation, and it was a pleasure, and hope to be back again.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the link with your colleagues and friends or with your connections on social media. If you'd like to find out more about the work that I do, head to www.colindellis.com or find me on LinkedIn.